It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you both back.
Thank you.
And thanks
to Peggy and Jeff and Vanessa for filling in for us last week, too. That was great.
Yeah, they were real troopers there. I was surprised how little arm twisting it took to get them in here.
Well, you know, once you had gathered that background information on them, I really don't think they had much choice.
Who could have imagined there'd be that much on them?
We'd love to have them back sometime, too.
So, instead of starting out with local, we're going to start out with the big item today, which of course is Ike.
Yeah, we will bring this back to local, trust me on this, but wanted to start with Ike for people who are just getting up or haven't been listening. It did hit into Galveston and has passed over Houston overnight last night. The first pictures this morning, and I say this in the context of I used to live in Galveston and as well as in Houston, and was in Galveston, in fact, for the last time there was a direct hurricane strike on Galveston, which was Alicia in 1983. And this storm is much worse. The good news is that the storm surge wasn't nearly as bad as they had predicted. They had thought it might be 20 to 25 feet. It looks now like it was maybe in the range of 10 to 12. But that said, that's still 10 to 12 feet above sea level, plus waves coming in on top of that. And they were talking about seas of 50 feet yesterday. On an island where the highest point of elevation is 9 feet and where some 23,000 people did not heed the mandatory evacuation orders and stayed behind last night in a city that is primarily one- and two-story houses and apartment buildings. The west end of the island, the end that is not protected by the seawall, looks basically indistinguishable from the Gulf of Mexico this morning. You can see a few treetops, a few tops of houses. That's about it. It's a very, very scary situation. And as the storm subsides there, we're going to find out more once the first responder crews start getting out and can look for bodies and rescue people who were stranded. We're going to find out more about the extent of the damage, but it's looking pretty grim this morning over there.
Now, when you lived in Galveston, Jav, you told me that the western part of Galveston Island wasn't developed much at all versus now.
Yeah, this is one thing that that is going to contribute greatly to the death toll. And this is something we've learned in past natural disasters, that almost without exception, the death toll in natural disasters like this is preventable and happens because of decisions that human beings make, whether it's decisions to live in a high-risk zone to begin with, things that are done to the environment that degrade the natural protections against disasters, such as happened with the loss of shoreline and the swamplands and wetlands around New Orleans during Katrina in 2005, whether it's things that the government does. In this case, the evacuation warnings came very late and only covered that area immediately surrounding the Galveston Bay and the coast where the storm surge was expected to be a problem. The west end of Galveston Island used to be pretty much uninhabited for exactly this reason, because it wasn't protected by the seawall. The greatest natural disaster in the history of the United States in terms of loss of life happened in Galveston in 1900, when some 8,000 people were essentially washed out to sea by a hurricane very similar to this one. And after that happened, they built a seawall to protect the city that rises some 17 feet along the Gulf of Mexico, and they also raised the island itself some 7 or 8 feet along the shore itself, so that the most vulnerable part of the island is actually the backside of the island facing Galveston Bay. But the west end of the island over the last 20, 25, 30 years has been the site of a lot of really cynical real estate development that's happened because resorts and subdivisions and hotels have been brought in along the shore with the understanding that, sure, they're going to get hit by a hurricane someday, but that'll be covered by insurance and they'll make a lot of money in the meantime. And, of course, the people who buy into these properties, particularly the houses and the condos and the townhomes, can lose everything. everything. But the people who actually develop the properties get their money and get out. Of course, the lack of zoning that part of the country is notorious for helps this problem. The lack of master planning helps this process a lot too. And you have to understand also there is an endemic distrust of government in Texas. And I think that extends not only to distrust of government planning and zoning and things like that, but also a distrust of things like evacuation orders. People went through Rita in 2005, just after Katrina, where there was nearly 100% compliance with evacuation orders from Galveston. The hurricane wound up not being a direct strike. It veered off to the east and wasn't particularly bad at all, but the evacuation itself, because of the very bad evacuation plan, was a catastrophe. And so I was listening last night to the local news station in Houston that was covering the hurricane, and they were taking phone calls from people and were asking them, well, why did you stay behind? And to the person, they all said, well, we left during a Rita and it was horrible, and so we decided not to do that this time.
The city, the Houston city government, told them to stay put.
Well, that was for Houston. Mm-hmm. That's 60 miles inland, and that's a defensible decision.
Mm-hmm.
But they did evacuate.
But you're talking about along the
coast. I'm talking about along the coast and along the bay where mm-hmm. the storm surge was going to hit. A lot of people there stayed put as well.
Wow.
And that's a real problem. But you have this distrust of government, and then you have a situation where the government turns out to be wrong because, of course, you know, particularly for hurricanes, forecasting is still an inexact science. And the next time people just don't pay heed. You've also seen this situation where people make irrational decisions, and we'll come back to this later on in the program when we talk about Sarah Palin. but they make decisions like, you know, they don't want to leave because they don't want to be separated from their pets. Well, if you want to die for your dog or cat, that's a decision you're entitled to make, but it's not a very rational decision. And we've seen this also in studies of disaster planning in general, where particularly for evacuation from real-time disasters, for example, an earthquake or a tsunami, the type of disaster that Seattle is much more vulnerable to. A lot of people won't leave because, for instance, parents, if their children are in school, want to make sure that their children are safe before they would evacuate. The issue with family pets, the issue of wanting to protect property from looters. This was a big one in Texas. These are things that cause people to not evacuate. And in a city like Seattle, which is vulnerable to a natural disaster, particularly an earthquake, does have serious egress issues because there's I-5 and I-90 are the only two major ways out of the entire metropolitan area, and really I-5 is the only major thoroughfare that you can get in and out of the city proper because the bridges wouldn't be safe in the event of any kind
vulnerable.
Of natural disaster.
An earthquake, so you could lose I-5 very easily.
Yes, you could. So we talked about this after the earthquake we had here a few years ago that didn't do a whole lot of damage, although we're still left with the Alaska Way Viaduct result. The emergency planning for Seattle really needs a lot of work, and the disaster preparedness awareness of people in this region needs a lot of work too. And it's very frightening to see what could happen because, you know, Houston, Galveston, that's a major metropolitan area. It's larger than Seattle. It's about 4.5 million people in that area. And they're really hurting this morning.
They're entirely without power. The plan, when I was reading about the preparations for Hurricane Ike, I was reading, you know, that these people have to stay put, that the only reinsurances they were given was that, you know, some 5 million ready meals are on the way. That's going to feed, 4.5 million people once. You know, I mean, that's not even going to cover their needs for a day. So I'm looking at this thinking, well, it's not so much what's going on local. It's what's going on at the federal level for emergency planning and preparedness. And unfortunately, it's exactly the same thing we saw with Hurricane Katrina,
absolutely.
We saw with the Bush administration, even trying to do planning or no planning, that is, for the war in Iraq. It's basically let's just let it happen, then leave the outcome to private contractors to deal with. We'll throw a lot of taxpayer money at it. Much of that's going to disappear into contractors' pockets. They're going to provide little or no services to the people who need it, and a lot of people will suffer.
And at 3 years after Katrina, FEMA is still being run by political hacks, and FEMA in turn is a subset of the Department of Homeland Security, which is still run by Michael Chertoff, who was really criminally negligent during Katrina. And he still has that same job 3 years later.
So yeah. So what I'm afraid is that we're going to see in the coming days that it's exactly the same story as Katrina. A lot of misery and not a lot of help from the outside. So the lesson we learn here in Seattle is that if we have a natural disaster, we're going to be pretty much on our own, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's that way across the country. Mm-hmm. The other thing about Galveston is it's home to one of the five biosafety level 4 labs in the country. You know, and you have to question the wisdom of, oh, let's put one of the nastiest things in the U.S.
Cited actually where I used to work at the University of Texas Medical Center on Galveston
Island.
It's
in an area that regularly floods. That's a
yes, it is. And it's underwater this morning as well.
And with no power.
Of course, we're also going to be affected because the Houston Ship Canal, which was also vulnerable to the ship surge, is an area where I also used to work that is home to the nation's largest concentration of petrochemical factories and is a major oil processing port. We're going to get hit with probably already have been hit with rising gasoline prices as a result, and it really once again makes you question the wisdom of offshore oil drilling.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to local, and starting with the Bellevue teacher strike.
Yeah, the Bellevue teachers were still out this week. There's been news just in the last day or so of a tentative agreement. We don't know the terms of the agreement. We know that the school district and the teachers were fairly far apart on issues of wage increases, and the stickiest point was the curriculum issue. Teachers wanted more flexibility in designing their lesson plans, and the district kept coming up with the most vague language you can imagine as far as allowing them to occasionally make changes, but not specifying what that actually means, how often they can do it, and what kind of process they would need to go through in order to get those changed lesson plans approved. Well, I think the most interesting thing was that at Wednesday's school board meeting in Bellevue, the Bellevue school board did, I think, a pretty civilized thing. They had people who were coming to the meeting, parents in particular, and teachers and others. They at the door, they gave them different colored cards so that they could vote, actually take a real vote on the question of whether or not the school board should go to a court and should take the teachers union to court and force them back to work. And if you contrast this with the way Seattle school district meetings are held, the contrast is pretty clear. Here, this was done very, very competently and in a very civilized way, and there was, as it turned out, a lot of support, particularly from parents, for the teachers' union and for continued negotiations rather than forcing the teachers back to work. Well, I don't think we would see the same thing in a similar situation here in Seattle.
Yeah, the Seattle school district for many years, you know, with the exception of the few years when the reform group had control of the school board, but the old boy and gal network is back in control again. And with the exception of the Port of Seattle, I think the Seattle School District has the most contempt for the general public of any public agency in the region. And
hence you get a lot of anger from parents.
Yes,
and
because of that. And I think if there were any kind of conflict like this with the Seattle schools, it would be handled in a very, very different way than Bellevue has handled it.
All right. Strike to the Boeing machinists.
Yeah, the Boeing machinist strike. Some 27,000 machinists are now out on strike against Boeing. The big issues are pay, of course, and health benefits, issues about the pension plan. And the biggest sticking point, though, is on the issue of subcontracting and outsourcing of parts production for Boeing airliner lines, particularly the Dreamliner, which Boeing outsourced the production of parts to companies all over the world, and that has led to a lot of problems and a 14-month delay in the production of the Dreamliner. Now, the company is coming out and trying to blame the strike for further delays. I think the strikers really need to push a little harder to get across the message that we're largely out on strike because if you had left the production of these parts in-house, if you had not subcontracted them out, the Dreamliner would be on time. The union this week also filed an unfair labor practices complaint against Boeing for trying to take their proposal directly to the employees and bypassing the union. And Boeing was also hit this week by SPIA. They presented their contract offer to Boeing. Their contract's going to be up on December 1st. And what was interesting is that SPIA had listed very, very similar demands to the Boeing to what the Boeing machinists had, including limiting contracting and outsourcing.
All right. Moving on, Isaac Zamora.
Yeah, Isaac Zamora. We've been hearing a lot in the news about the funerals for the six people who were shot in Skagit County in the past week and a half by Isaac Zamora. What we're not hearing a whole lot about is coverage of Zamora's domestic violence record, particularly the eight convictions he had, and including an attempted murder against one of his ex-girlfriends, and the fact that none of those convictions led to any sizable amount of jail time and no mental health evaluations at all. It really sends the message not only that the mental health system in this city, in this state, is completely broken, but it also sends the message that violence against women is okay. And it doesn't matter if you beat or try to kill an ex-girlfriend or your wife, you're going to get a pass. And unfortunately, when you give habitual abusers like that a pass, often you end up with an enormous tragedy like we did in the last week.
All right. And then moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, lots of economic news this week, particularly banks in bad trouble. Fannie and Freddie, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Fannie and Freddie bailout. It's been estimated at a $25 billion bailout, but it's going to be much, much bigger than that, probably the largest bailout in history. Fannie and Freddie are going to be put under conservatorship. That means that the federal government is going to seize their assets, going to sell off the ones that they think are valuable, and downsize the companies and probably eventually try to either keep them functioning as much smaller entities, or maybe even get rid of them altogether. Some people have called that nationalizing the two companies. It's really not. It's taking over the companies to reprivatize them. And the difference between that and nationalizing, in nationalizing companies, what usually happens is a government will go in and seize the assets of a company and because they're valuable and want to keep them on their books and run the companies and collect the profits from the sale of whatever products or services those companies produce. But in this case, what we're doing is we're nationalizing the debt. We're taking on assets that are largely have no value or very, very little value, going to sell off anything that is of value to the private industry. So selling off the good stuff and keeping the bad, and making, in the case of Fannie and Freddie, making a market in mortgage-backed securities to keep the credit markets afloat and to save banks that own those securities, because most of those securities are owned by banks and foreign governments. So it's not only just an economic issue here at home, it's a world economic issue, and it's also a foreign policy issue that has determined that we have to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Also this week, the Washington Mutual Board fired CEO Kerry Killinger. We could have seen that coming, should have come a lot sooner, particularly since Kerry Killinger had the option to do exactly what Alan Fishman, is the new CEO, is doing, which is sell off some of WaMu's bad assets and try to find a buyer for what's left over. That's something that Killinger had the choice of doing earlier in the year, and instead he decided, no, I'm not going to sell to J.P. Morgan Chase. I'm going to go find some investors to pour more money more good money after bad into the company. Unfortunately, those investors who bought a portion of Washington Mutual when it was $8.75 a share are crying now that it's between $2 and $3 a share. That's almost certainly is what led to Killinger's ouster. And once again, we hear of J.P. Morgan Chase looking at buying up Washington Mutual, and that's likely to be what's going to happen very soon. Also, Lehman Brothers Bank, the fourth largest investment bank in the country, is headed right in the same direction that Bear Stearns was headed in. They're also scrambling around after declaring a $4 billion loss in the for the third quarter of this year. They're scrambling around looking for desperately for a buyer, and if they can't do it, I guess the federal government gets to step in again. So that sums up the economic news for this week.
All right. Any other numbers you want to throw at us?
No, I think we'll pass on those
okay.
this week.
Then we'll go over to Mr. Parrish, who is was one of the reasons you were gone. You were at the Democratic National Convention.
Yes, it was. And, of course, that's kind of become old news at this point. But it was very interesting and very striking being in Denver. Not so much because of the protests, which were something of a letdown, although there were unprovoked crackdowns. Those were actually worse in Minnesota than they were in Denver. But the convention itself, the parts that don't make the television and where all the real business of the convention gets done is sort of behind the scenes at the caucus meetings, the parties, the hospitality suites, and so forth. And something that you know intellectually, but you don't really understand until you see it up front, is just how bad the lobbying and the corporate presence is. You see something like, you know, there's 20,000 lobbyists for every human being in Washington, D.C., and you don't really internalize that until you go to Denver and you see something like, you know, the Washington State delegation to the convention, their breakfast in the morning before they even go to the convention, and in subsequent mornings they were sponsored by Eli Lilly and Amgen and some other pharmaceutical company, and then you wonder why we don't have any universal health insurance in this country, and why the Democrats have laid down on telecommunications immunity when another one was sponsored by Quest and another one was sponsored by Verizon and so forth. Of course, all the free swag from the corporations too. That was a really striking piece of it. But in watching and observing the two different conventions, and of course the subsequent vice presidential pick of Sarah Palin, there's been a really striking dynamic that has happened in this race the past couple, 3 weeks especially, although we were seeing some inklings of it earlier, with the pick of Sarah Palin as vice presidential pick and the difference between the Democrats and the Republican conventions, where the Democrats were trying to talk all about issues and you know, what they would do on the economy and what they would do in foreign policy and so forth. And they're in a position to do this because the majority of Americans agree with them on most of these issues. The Republicans are not. And so what they have done instead is not only making it a campaign about personalities and about attacking the other side, which is what most of the speeches at the RNC were about, but In the selection of Sarah Palin, I think we're seeing the first truly anti-intellectual presidential campaign we've ever seen. Not just an appeal to emotion, because we've always had appeals to emotion as part of a presidential campaign. I mean, a chicken in every pot was an appeal to emotion. But we're seeing appeals to emotion in the absence of anything else. And we're seeing it in the context of defining Barack Obama as an other, not just because he's black and you're not, which is a subtext for a fair amount of what the Republicans are saying, but also because he's smart and you're not.
And he can think.
Yeah. Sarah Palin is the American Idol contestant for the most powerful job in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, she's somebody who is photogenic, who has a charming personality, although, you know, somewhat sarcastic, and really, you could see yourself up there doing what she's doing.
No, actually, I'd do a better job.
Well,
I'm sure,
yes.
Of it.
Well, that's. But I'm talking about for
and
the,
she's older
for,
than me.
For the average person in a trailer park in you know, some corner of America, you know, they could see themselves doing what Sarah Palin is doing. Mm-hmm. it's really very frightening, and you have to wonder what the rest of the world is thinking, that they are so much at the mercy of who America elects as its leader, and this is what our political campaigns have devolved to. It's very, very frightening and very, very discouraging, and let's hope it doesn't carry the day in November.
Yeah, one of the, I think, you know, there have been many, many things that we've seen about Sarah Palin printed, some of them true, some of them not. I think the most disturbing thing that I've seen is that this week the Senate of Alaska voted to subpoena 13 individuals in the investigation of the firing of the chief public safety officer in Alaska by Sarah Palin. And one of those individuals was her husband, Todd. And in the article I read about it, it appears that Todd Palin gets copied on all of the major emails that are sent about public policy in the state of Alaska, and that he has a lot of control in her government. And to me, that tells me that...
Well,
right,
you know,
there
God's place for a wife
not
to
vote for
her husband.
Yeah, that's the main reason not to vote for her, because, you know, I mean, she clearly isn't doing her work on her own. It's her and her husband, and I'm sorry, but that, to me, that's just probably the worst thing I could have ever heard about her.
Yeah, the other thing that's been really striking is the succession of blatant and repeated serial lies that are coming out of the McCain-Palin campaign.
After McCain said that he would never run a dishonest campaign.
Yeah, and to their credit, the mainstream media is starting to call them on this, but the McCain campaign is clearly betting on the idea that it doesn't matter if they lie, that that people are going to look at the media calling them on it and saying, well, that's the media, they're being biased, and that they can lie with impunity. And this is the next logical step from what the Bush administration has been doing for the last 8 years. And it's very, very frightening, because if they're running a campaign like this, you can only imagine how they would govern.
Yeah.
Well, didn't they in Washington State just pass a law saying, or pass a judge vote that said lying on a campaign is completely fine?
Yeah, that was the Supreme Court ruling.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Moving on to international and Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, we've seen more reports this week. The United States with troops in Pakistan with more bombings, 12 people reportedly killed yesterday in Pakistan. This has huge foreign policy implications for that part of the world, particularly with a new government being sworn in Pakistan. And it's getting very little attention in the United States because of the presidential campaign and now because of the hurricane. And just keep an eye on that. That's a very serious development.
Yeah, I think what's interesting too is that Pakistan, with its new government, has been stressing that it would not allow any foreign government to conduct any kind of military exercises on its territory without its approval. And the Bush administration in the past has not ever said that it would do that, that it would always consult with the Pakistani government, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, George Bush has been secretly authorizing U.S. troops to go ahead and pursue military options on Pakistani soil without informing the Pakistani government first. That's a dangerous situation, particularly for U.S. troops in that position, because they could come under fire from Pakistani government troops and they would never know. And Pakistani government troops would never know who they were killing or who they were pursuing. It's an extremely dangerous and volatile situation, and nobody's really calling George Bush on it.
Yeah, and if you remember, a number of months ago, Barack Obama got a lot of criticism from Republicans for saying he'd pursue Osama bin Laden in Pakistan without Pakistani government approval if that scenario were to arise. This isn't pursuing bin Laden. This is simply doing military exercises in Pakistan.
All right, events?
Yeah, several coming up. Today, Barbara Lee, the congresswoman, is going to be at Elliott Bay Books at 4:30 today. Next Thursday at Keystone Church in Wallingford, Kathy Kelly, the renowned nonviolent activist who's done a lot of work breaking the sanctions in Iraq and with various Middle East things, founder of Voices in the Wilderness, she will be at Keystone, 5019 Keystone Place North in Wallingford, Thursday at 7 p.m. And then an early plug on September 20th. 28th as part of our 12th anniversary. Eat the State is going to be having a party the evening that Sunday at Not Our Number Books and Gifts in Wallingford. Look for details on that. And that is, will also wrap up our summer fund drive, which we desperately need money at this point. So if you can help out Eat the State, we would very much appreciate it. It is an all-volunteer publication. We have been getting harassing phone calls from our printer because we're several thousand dollars in debt to them. So go to www.eatthestate.org, hit on PayPal and make a donation or send your donation to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And of course, we always need writers and distributors and volunteers of all kinds. So if you want to help out in that way, we very much appreciate your participation.
All right. And what is the other contact info?
Oh, if you want to get a hold of us, our email address is info@eatthestate.org, or you can give our voicemail a call at area code 206-719-6947.